Good morning, everybody. Boker Tov. Welcome. We have a nice new microphone today, so we shouldn't have any more mishaps. And hopefully we'll have no crackling either. We have a dedication for the shir. I'd like to read that out. Today's shirim at the OU Israel Center are dedicated for Refuah Shleima, for Chaim Tzvi Ben Yenta Bluma, and we wish Chaim Tzvi Ben Yenta Bluma a Refuah Shleima, B'chol Chol Yisrael, and please God, we should learn in his schutz that he should have that Refuah Shleima, and we should do some good learning together. Now, I promised you something a little bit technological, and I think we're going to have a little bit of fun today with this. Let's start with a quote from an article that came out about 5 or 6 weeks ago in the Detroit Free Press. I don't have any particular connection with Detroit. Some of you here may be from Detroit, from Michigan. But let's have a look what Todd Spangler wrote in November about driverless cars. Let's start with this. Consider this hypothetical. It is a bright, sunny day and you're alone in your spanking new self-driving vehicle, sprinting along the two-lane tunnel of trees on the M119, high above Lake Michigan, north of Harbor Springs. Doesn't mean much to me, but if you're from there, you'll be able to picture the scene. You're sitting back, enjoying the view. You're looking out through the trees, trying to get a glimpse of the crystal blue water below you, moving along at the 45 miles per hour speed limit. Because, of course, you're in a self-drive car. It's not going to drive faster than the speed limit, is it? As you approach a rise in the road, heading south, a school bus appears, driving north, one driven by a human. And it veers sharply towards you. There is no time to stop safely and no time for you to take control of the car and override the driverless car setting. Does the car, A, swerve sharply into the trees, possibly killing you, but possibly saving the bus and its occupants? B, perform a sharp, evasive maneuver around the bus into the oncoming lane, possibly saving you, but sending the bus and its driver swerving into the trees, killing some of the children on board? Or C, hit the bus, possibly killing you as well as the driver and the kids on the bus? In everyday driving, such no-win choices, he writes, are to be made maybe exceedingly rare. But when they happen, what should a self-driving car programmed in advance do? Or in any situation, even a less dire one, where a moral snap judgment must be made. It is not just a theoretical question anymore, with predictions that in a few years, tens of thousands of semi-autonomous vehicles may be on the roads. Around $80 billion has been invested in the field. Tech companies are working feverishly on them. There's every reason for excitement. Self-driving vehicles will ease commuting, return lost time to workers, enhance mobility for seniors, those with physical challenges, and sharply reduce more than 35,000 deaths on the U.S. highways. But there are also a host of nagging questions to be sorted out as well. What happens to cab drivers? Okay, that you may not be too worried about that, but what happens to cab drivers? And whether such vehicles will create sprawl. And there is an existential question. Who dies when the car is forced into a no-win situation? There will be crashes, said Van Lindberg, an attorney in the Dykema law firm San Antonio office, who specializes in autonomous vehicles issues. Unusual things will happen. Trees will fall. Animals, kids will dart out. Even a self-driving car saves thousands of lives, he said. Anyone who gets the short end of that stick is going to be pretty unhappy about it. Few people seem to be in a hurry to take on these questions, at least publicly. It is unaddressed, for example, in legislation moving through Congress that could result, and this is right, this is current, this was written just a few weeks ago, could result in tens of thousands of autonomous vehicles being put on the roads. In new guidance for automakers by the U.S. Department of Transportation, it is consigned to a footnote that says only that ethical considerations are, quote, important, unquote, and links to a brief acknowledgement that, quote, no consensus around acceptable ethical decision-making has been reached. Now, that's all very well to write that in their recommendations, but Lemaitre, when you go to buy your autonomous car, or to lease your autonomous car. And one of my insurance brokers recently told me that we may be living in a world in not so many years from now where people don't own cars at all. If I need a car to take me from Alan Schwartz to the OU Israel Center, Toyota or whoever it is will just own hundreds of thousands of cars, and I'll just order one on my phone or, you know, press my head or whatever it is that bleeps into and connects into whatever, and a car will just, an autonomous car will roll up at the door a few minutes later. I'll just get in, I'll have a subscription to whoever it is, and then I'll just get out of the OU center and it'll drive off and pick up someone else. And that's how it'll work. There's no drivers on the road, just people in little bubbles running around on the streets. This is not science fiction. This is this could be happening sooner than we think. And the truth is that we need to know how to program these cars. They will do what they're programmed to do. You may be able to override them, but the whole joy of these cars is they don't need you to override them. And when people make these decisions, who knows on what basis the people make them? Split-second decisions. And therefore, I brought you on page 2, when considering how to program these cars, I've brought you a number of interesting moral questions that come out of this. The truth is, there are other areas as well. When we're programming robots to fight in military situations as well, how are we going to program the robots? Who is going to die to be saved? Civilians, military personnel, etc. They're also going to have to give a lot of thought to that too. But I brought you 5 or 6 scenarios. Let's just have a look at them. Some of them were raised in the little quote that we saw just now. How do you judge between people around you in split-second decisions? What if the person with you in the car is your child? Does that make a difference? Of course it does emotionally, but you're asking to program the car. They may ask you when you book your subscription to this car or service, what kind of algorithm would you like, sir or madam? Would you like a car which is pre-programmed to kill the people around you or to kill the people in the car first rather than the people around you? Okay, and this is a real question. What if it's somebody else's child? If a child runs in front of you, do you hit the child and swerve into a fixed barrier, putting yourself at risk? If a child runs into the road in front of your car, do you swerve to avoid her and hit an oncoming van head on? What happens if, depending on the identity of the pedestrian? Does it matter if it's a child that may be hit, or an elderly person, or a frail person? Do you take into account their future life value, their likelihood of survival, their level of suffering compared with a normal, quote, average person? Does it make a difference if you know who they are? What if it's a mass murderer that you might have the opportunity to swerve into? What if it's a brain surgeon? Would it be ethical to prioritize one over the other? What if it's a motorcyclist who has chosen to drive something with less protection? Do you take that into account and say, well, if he drives a motorcycle, that's his problem? Or do you say, no, he's more likely to be hurt, therefore I won't swerve into him? Yes, sir?
All these ethical considerations apply right now with driving.
They do, but we... Good. I agree with you 100%, meaning we have to make these decisions on the spur of the moment, and we probably don't make them very well, because we haven't really thought them through, and even if we thought them through, the way we react in a panic situation is not based on what we thought through. So yes, you're right, this is forcing us to think in a very serious way about this. What if there are 10 people crossing the road? Do you hit the 10, or do you hit the 2, etc.? Now, I brought you at the bottom here, at the Toulouse School of Economics. My sister-in-law did some studying into this. She's an engineer, and some of this material comes from her. At the Toulouse School of Economics, they're using the new science of experimental ethics to ask people how they respond. For example, 76% of people thought it would be more moral to sacrifice one passenger in the car rather than kill 10 pedestrians. Okay? This dropped to 23% when there was only one pedestrian. So people obviously think in utilitarian ways. I'd rather sacrifice 1 for 10 than 1 for 1. If it's 1 for 1, I'd rather it was them, not me. Okay, which is understandable. We'll see some sources of this soon. Another experiment in Sweden, you won't like this, studied the relative values of different groups of people and found that people thought that a 10-year-old pedestrian was worth, quote-unquote, 4.6 70-year-old driver. Meaning when people are pushed as to how they're going to actually judge the situations, they have to start making decisions on this, and we'll talk a little bit at the end of this year as to whether we can really do anything to practice or work on those decisions. Let's have a look at some makarot, because it's all very well putting these moral issues out there. How are we going to deal with them? Clearly the US Congress is not dealing with them. They're just hoping that it will happen, but there are a lot of people talking about them. Very often, this is expressed in terms of what they call the plane crash dilemmas, loya leinu, but there are a number of dilemmas, thought experiments, which are put, and some of them are not just theoretical. The two classic ones are if a plane is out of control and will inevitably crash into a densely populated area. Should the pilot divert the plane, it'll crash either way, but should he divert it into a less populated area and choose to kill those people who are completely innocent rather than these people who it's currently heading towards who are also innocent, but there are far more of them? Is that the right thing for the pilot to do? And most people, when they're asked that question, seem to intuitively say, yes, that is the right thing to do. He should try and crash into less people rather than crash into an urban area with more people. We'll see if that's correct. And the hijacked plane scenario, which we'll be really looking at mostly when trying to work out the car scenario, which very tragically is not a theoretical scenario. This is what happened on 9/11, which is when you have a hijacked plane and there is an option to shoot down the plane, the military can shoot down the plane in order to stop it from crashing into a highly populated area, but will kill the people on the plane. Is that the correct thing to do? And as you probably know, and I put it in the note here, this was indeed the scenario after three planes on 9/11 had already crashed, two into the Twin Towers and one into the Pentagon. Dick Cheney gave an order, who was the vice president, he was in Washington, President Bush was in Florida, if you remember. Dick Cheney gave an order to the U.S. military to scramble two F-16s and to shoot down the next passenger jet, which was going to fly into a populated area, which they think was going towards the Capitol building. In the end, that plane was not shot down. It crashed in Pennsylvania, and it looks as though it was brought down by the passengers who overran the hijackers. But it's an interesting question as to what would have been the debate if that plane had been shot down. As a side issue, it's not clear whether President Bush ever gave that order. That's the whole question, or whether Cheney just did it anyway. But that's not for today's shit. How do we deal with these on a halachic level, on a hashkafic level? What are the makorot that we can bring to bear? And the truth is, this is actually quite a complex area. And let's see if we can make our way through it and keep clarity as we go through these different scenarios. First of all, there are conflicting mitzvot. Have a look on page number 3, please. Let's look at sources 2 through 4. There is a mitzvah of Lo Tamod al Dam Re'echa. You may not stand by while other people will die if there's something you can do to help them. And again, I'm not resolving anything with these right now. I'm just putting them out there. There is a mitzvah of Lo Tamod al Dam Re'echa, and the Rambam brings that in Halacha in Hilchos Rotzeh v'Shmiras HaNefesh. Look at number 3. Kol Hayochel Ahatzel. If you can save anybody. V'loy Hitzel, but you choose not to. Oiva Aloy Tamod al Dam Re'echa. Now, obviously, there are more details of how much danger to your own life, etc. But if you could save and you don't, in principle, that's a breach of a Torah mitzvah. If you see one of your friends someone else drowning in the sea, or listim by malav, or you see them being attacked by bandits, or chayra ba'alav, or you see them being attacked by a wild animal, and you have the ability to save them, again, leaving aside danger to yourself, that's a separate issue. If you choose not to just stand by, you're breaking a Torah mitzvah. And similarly, Haroi Roidef, and we're going to get back to the Roidef soon, if you see a Roidef, someone chasing, Achachavero, a human being making a moral choice to chase after somebody else, and we'll see if the Roidef has to be guilty or not guilty, Lahargo, or Acha Erva, or not a murder scenario, but a, God forbid, a rape scenario, Labayala, and someone is a predator trying to attack someone to rape them, V'yachol Atzil, and you are able to stop that, V'loy Hitzil, and you don't, you are breaking 3 Torah mitzvahs, says the Rambam. Hare debikul mitzvahs atzei shehi uksatai kapah. That the mitzvah, it says there, when a woman is in the scenario where 2 men are fighting and 1 woman is able to reach in and stop one of the men, etc., you have to stop someone who is a roidef. I'm not getting into all of the details of that now. We talked about that a little bit in another situation. You have to do that mitzvah. Va'avar al shnei lavim, and there are 2 negative mitzvahs. Loi sachot enecha, do not have pity on the roidef. Va'aloi tamod adam riecha, and don't stand by while your friend is being attacked. So we have clearly a mitzvah to intervene. You cannot just not do anything and say, well, it's not my problem. That's the first imperative. There is also a mitzvah not to kill people. Okay, number 4, Lefikach Nivra Adam Yechidi, says the Mishnah, man, Adam, Harishon, was created alone. The Lam Bechal to teach you, Shekolam Abed Nefesh Echad Mishrael. Anyone who takes 1 Jewish life, Male Alav Akosu Ki'ilu Ibed Oilam Male, as if he killed the whole world. Because originally there was just 1 person, leaving aside Jewish or not Jewish. Adam Harishon, of course, was not Jewish. He was a human being. Let's leave it a human being. And if you save one life, it's as if you saved the whole world. So that's all very nice. We know this already, but it's important to restate it that there are multiple mitzvot that kick in when we have the ability to save people and an obligation not to hurt people. We have to work out how to prioritize them. Because the difficulty with our scenarios is, in order to save one, I have to kill another. And that's when it gets difficult. So let's go through those scenarios and see what halachas we can put on them. So the first situation I brought here is where it's one life versus another life. And we talked about this when we talked about abortion. If you remember, about a year ago, a bit less now, we dealt with the issues with abortion. And this case is brought in the Mishnah from an abortion scenario in number 5. Ha'isha shehi maksha leilat. A woman who is having very strong difficulties, very bad difficulties, giving birth, in real trouble. Mechapchim et avlad b'meyeha. We will cut up the fetus. We will abort the fetus inside her. Umoisim ota eivarim eivarim, and bring it out limb by limb. We will not save the fetus if it's going to cost her mother's life. Mitnei shechaya chayeha koydin l'chayav. Her life comes before the life of her fetus. That's very clear. We will kill a fetus to save the mother. But yatsa rubai, but once the majority of the fetus comes out, which could be either the majority of the head, if it's born in a normal scenario, or if it's the majority of the body, if it's born breech, once the majority of the child has come out, ein noigin bo. We cannot touch the child to save the mother. She'ein doichin nefesh mitnei nefesh. Because you can never kill one person to save another person. And while the fetus is a fetus, it's not really yet fully a person. We talked about this when we talked about abortion. I refer you to that share for full details. It's on the website too. But once it is born, then it's a person. And you cannot kill one person to save another person. And we know this from a non-birth scenario as well. Look in number 6, Sanhedrin, quite famous. Amar Rav Yochanan, Mishum Rav Shimon Bar Yotzadok. Nimnu v'gamru v'aliyat beit nitzah balut. They make this clear statement in halacha. Kol aveira shebetorah. Any aveira in the Torah. Im oimrim la'adam. If a person were to say to you, avor, do the aveira. Va'al tarek, and don't be killed. Ya avor, and then you should do the aveira. Va'al tarek, yarek, and don't be killed. If someone says, eat this pork or I'll kill you, there's no question. Eat the pork. Bring it on. Because you don't have to die rather than eat pork. Chutzme, apart from the classic, avodah zarah, gilui arayis, ushvichas damah. You are not allowed to murder people or to commit sexual immorality or avodah zarah, even to save life, even to save one's own life. In the case of murder, why is that? Why cannot indeed one person murder another in order to save their own life? So again, I think, as is quite well known, the Gemara in Pesachim presents the argument. In number 7, Shvichas damim gufei min olam. How do I know this rule applies to murder? Why can I not murder to save life? Says the Gemara, svarahu. Very interesting. It doesn't bring a pasuk. It doesn't bring a verse in the Torah. It says it's a svara. It's logical. And that's very interesting, because once you say it's logical, it challenges to apply that logic to other scenarios, maybe where it's less logical. We'll see how it works. It's a logical analysis. Ki Yahuda asked the Kamid Rava, like the case that came in front of Rava. Amalei, where the man said to him, Mari Dura, who is a bandit, this bandit, Amalei, said to me, Zil katle leplaini. Go and kill this other person. The Eloi, and if you don't, Katlin Alach, I'm going to kill you. I've got a gun, he's got a gun to the guy's head. Kill this other person or I'm killing you. Amalei, he said, Rabbi said, the answer is, Likadluch, you have to die. V'loi tikam. And you're not allowed to kill other people. Why? My chazi d'dama d'deich sumakfei. Why do you think your blood is redder? Dilma d'ama d'ahu gavra sumakfei. Maybe the blood of the other person is redder than your blood. What does it mean, whose blood is redder? Meaning, you can't weigh one life against another. You're alive, one second, you're alive and he's alive or she's alive. How do you know that your life has greater value than their life? If it's a life, it is a life, you can't make that analysis. You were about to say, but...
But if you know that he's going to kill you plus the other person...
Ah, he didn't say that.
You know, but you
because know. How do you know that two lives are greater than one life? Or five lives are greater than one life? How do you know? You don't know, and we're going to see in a minute, even if multiple people will die, you still can't say, you can't take a life to save them in the normal circumstances. And we're going to see that right now, because now we're moving from one versus one, which is very clear, to one versus many, which is much less clear. Have a look here in number 8. The Mishnah in Trumas picks this up in the case of a rape scenario. Number 8. Kol nashim sha'amru lehem oidei kachavim. If women were attacked by a group of aggressors, and they said, snu achav nichem, give us one of you, the nitma, and we're going to rape that woman, ve'imlav, and if not, hari anu matamim et kulchem. We're going to rape you all, including that woman. Okay? Meaning, either give us one, and the rest of you will be safe, or none of you will be safe. Says the Gemara, Yitamu et kolam, they all have to agree to be raped. Va'al yimasru lahem nefesh achat miYisrael. They are not allowed to hand over anybody. Even if that person in the end will also be attacked, they are not allowed to hand a person over in order to protect the rest of them. Now, that's interesting. That's not talking about murder. We'll apply to murder in a minute. But that seems to say that even a utilitarian argument that you might run in terms of, Jeremy Bentham and the greatest good to the greatest number, etc., that doesn't seem to be the moral approach that it's taking here. It's taking much more of a what they call a deontological position, which is that there are rules, and I'm not going to weigh up the greatest good against the greatest number. This is the rule. You cannot hand someone over to be raped. Now, in the case of murder, When the Tosefta picks up that Mishnah and applies it to murder, it adds another very important factor, which is the Sheva Ben Bichri factor, which again, some of you are familiar with, but let's have a look at that together. I'm not going to read all the psukim number 9. 9 is the story of Sheva Ben Bichri. I think you probably know the story. If you don't, then I'll summarize it very quickly. Yoav, David HaMelech's general, is chasing after a rebel, Sheva Ben Bichri. He comes across a town here, and he's about to ransack the town in order to get Sheva ben Bichri out. And then Isha Chachama, a wise woman of the town, comes out to Yoav and says, listen, why should you kill the whole town? Why are you killing all these innocent people? And Yoav says, I don't want innocent people. I just want Sheva ben Bichri. And she says, fine, here he is. And she chops off his head, throws it out, and says, there you are. Done. Okay? And he says, thank you very much, and goes home. I'm sure it was more complicated than that, but you can read the psukim yourself in number 9 as to how he came on the town there and how they killed Sheva ben Bichri. Now the Tosefta picks up Sheva ben Bichri in the following. Now let's look carefully at this because this could be read in different ways. Number 10. This is the Tosefta which parallels the Mishnah. The Tosefta was almost the first commentary written on the Mishnah. It was put together just a few decades after the Mishnah, dealing with the same kinds of cases, but in more, elaborating more. Okay, number 10. Tiashel bnei Adam, a group of people, sha'amru lehem, goyim, and they're attacked by non-Jewish people who want to kill them, and they say, tnu lanu echad mechem, give us one of you, benargehu, and we will kill that person, ve'imlav, and if not, hari anu horgimet kulchem. This is like the rape case, but it's a case of murder. Hand over one person, and we'll take them and kill them. If not, we'll kill everybody. Says the Gemara, says the Tosefta, Yargu Kolam, just like we saw before, they must all die. The Al Yimasru Lahem, the Al Yimsru Lahem, Nefesh Echad Miyisrael. They're not allowed to give over a single person, even to save a whole town, even to save 1,000 people. You may not sacrifice one person to save 1,000 people. But says the Tosefta here, Aval Im Yichduhu Lahem, if they specify a person there, just like Yoav specified Sheva ben Bichri, then yitnu lahem, then they can give that person over, v'al yargu kulam, and they shouldn't get killed. That's what the basic first position of the Tosefta says, the Tanakama, that you may not hand over one person to save even many, you may not kill one to save many, and we'll see soon, killing them outright is even worse than handing them over. We have to keep thinking, how is this working with the car? If I'm trying to program the car to kill one, to save 10, etc., is it worse to swerve a car into somebody, or is it worse to hand over somebody to be killed by other people? You have to keep that in mind, okay? So it says that Tosefta, you cannot hand over one person to save many, but you can if they're specified. Because they're effectively a dead man walking. That's it. They've been picked. They're not randomly being chosen. They have been specified, and therefore they can be given over. I'm a Rabbi Yehuda. Rabbi Yehuda says the following. The Mizmar Memorim, what kind of a person are we talking about here? Bizman Shehu Bizne Vehem Bidechutz, that's only when he's inside and they're outside. We'll see what that means in a minute. Aval Bizman Shehu Bifnim Vehem Bidechutz, if everybody's in the same place, Hoyel Vehu Nerag Vehem Nerag, and since he's going to get killed anyway, Yitnuhu lahem va'al yargu kulam. They can definitely hand him over. If he's going to die anyway, for sure they can hand him over. Now, what case is he dealing with? Is he being machmir or is he being mekel? Is he being strict or is he being lenient? We'll get back to that in a second. Let's just finish off. V'chein hu omer, and he brings Sheva ben Bichri to the case. The woman came along, the Isha Chachama in her wisdom, and she gave him over, because he was going to die anyway. So said Rabbi Yehuda, if the person will die anyway, for sure you can hand them over. Rabbi Shimon says, no. In the case of Sheva ben Bichri, it wasn't as simple as just he was going to die. Kol hamoyred v'malchus beis David, chayv misa. You can hand him over not because he was going to die anyway, but because he deserves to die. He's a rebel. He's Sheva ben Bichri. That's why we can hand him over. But if he didn't deserve to die, then you can't hand him over. So what do we have here? We have a machlokes three ways between the Tanakhama. What did the Tanakhama say? The first opinion. You may never hand over one to save many, but you can if they've been specified. Okay? Rabbi Yehuda came along and said, if they're going to die anyway, you can hand them over. Rabbi Shimon said, if they're liable to death, because they're a rebel, liable to punishment, then you can hand them over. How are Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbi Shimon understanding the situation? What are they doing? Again, are they being lenient or are they being strict? What do I mean by that? Are they saying the following? What did the Tanakhama say? The Tanakhama said, if a person's not specified, you may not hand them over. But if they are specified, you may. Are Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbi Shimon coming to be lenient and say, excuse me, even if they're not specified, even if they never named anybody, if you can find someone that's going to die anyway, give them over. Or if you can find someone that's anyway liable to the death penalty, give them over, even if nobody was specified, meaning they're being more lenient and saying that you can even find people to give over without a specification. Or are they being strict, which is how we'll see almost all of the Mephoroshim are reading it and saying no. Even if they specify somebody, certainly if they don't specify anybody, you can't hand anybody over. But even if they do specify, there are other criteria and other boxes you have to check. It has to be someone who's going to die anyway, otherwise you can't hand them over. Or it has to be someone who's liable, or you can't hand them over. So which way are we going to read Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbi Shimon? They're being stricter or they're being more lenient? Yes. She killed him, but effectively, good, she killed him because he was a Moriba Malchus. So you're saying it supports Rabbi Shimon, meaning only someone who deserved to die at the hands of the government. She was like an agent of the government, if you like.
She doesn't know, she's not fine.
Interesting. Due process. Good. She's made a decision, she's killed him anyway. That's an interesting question, actually, which I didn't think about, which is, what gives her the right to kill him? Forget about handing him over. She had the right to hand him over, but she killed him anyway. We'd have to learn the Parashanut there and how that works, and I honestly don't know. I didn't think about that. It's a good question. Yes.
If a group of people would be handed over, and the group would decide that we will cast the poor.
Yes.
And someone will be ready, whoever
right.
it falls on, we will make that.
Good. And they all agree. They all agree to take lots. We'll get to that. We'll get to that case. That's the case, the famous case in English law of Dudley and Stevens. We'll get to Dudley and Stevens soon, and we'll get to the case in the Gemara as well. There's a parallel Gemara case, we'll see too. So are they being strict or are they being lenient? So almost all the Mephoroshim understand that they're being strict. That's how Rashi understands it in number 11. He's basically saying you have to be specified plus. You have to be specified and someone who's going to die anyway. Or specified and someone who's going to die and who's guilty, according to Rebbe Shimon. And that is how the Talmud Yerushalmi rules. It's interesting that this is not brought in the Bavli. It is brought in the Yerushalmi, but it picks up on that Tosefta. Let's look at number 12. Let's leave Rashi for now and look at number 12. Says the Gemara as follows. Tani. Siyos bnei adam shehayu mahalchim b'derech. Okay? Pagu lehem goyim. There's a group of people walking along the way, and they're attacked by bandits. The Amrun, they say, Snu lanu echem nichem. Give us one of you, v'na'arogata, and we'll kill him. The im laugh, and if not, hari anu horgim et kulchem. Same case, we're going to kill you all. So the Gemara here says, afilu kulam ne'arogim. Even if they're all going to die, Lo yimatsru nefesh achat miYisrael. One soul may not be handed over. The same idea, even if they're all going to die. But yichdu lahem echad, but if they did specify, kagoyim sheva ben bichri, then yimtsru oto va'al yaragu. So the same idea. If one is specified, they can hand him over. Amar Rebbe Shimon ben Lakish. What did Rebbe Shimon ben Lakish say? Vehu, and he's being strict, and that's only Sheyehechayv Misa, Kesheva ben Bichri, if he's fully liable to be killed anyway. Clearly in the Gemara, even though in the Tosefta we could read it either way, in the Gemara it's very clear. You can only hand him over if he's A, specified, and guilty. Rabbi Yochanan, Amar Rabbi Yochanan said, Afo Pisha Eino Chayev. No, he doesn't have to be Chayev Misa, Kesheva ben Bichri, like Sheva ben Bichri, you can still hand him over, as long as he's specified. So we have clearly in the Gemara here a Machlokas, and it comes basically down to this. You can never hand someone over if they're not specified. But if they are specified in some way, singled out, then there's a machlokas. Rabbi Yochanan will say, okay, you can hand them over. If they're going to die anyway, you can hand them over. And Rabbi Shimon will say, no, they have to be guilty in some way. If they're innocent, you can't hand them over. And we'll have to work out, who are we going to rule like? Are we going to rule like Rabbi Yochanan, who is more lenient, who will allow you to hand more people over? Or like Rabbi Shimon, Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai and Reish Lakish here, who is more, is stricter? Yes. Go on.
Because particularly in the real world, the likelihood that one of the choices is going to be someone who has been deemed liable.
Yes. Good. So you're saying, according to Reish Lakish, it makes it almost impossible to hand anybody over. Because if I have to know that the person is guilty and liable, etc., then I'm never going to be able to hand anybody over. And I'm just going to have to just leave it as it is. That may be a decision that we'll have to come to. We may have to decide that I'm not able to program the car to do anything other than what it's doing right now. We'll see that Tzitz Eliezer is going to come to that conclusion and say we just have to just hands off and go forwards. And whatever happens, happens. We'll see that in a minute. But it's an interesting point you're making that Reish Lakish seems to be putting a very high bar. Now, it may be that there are other factors we'll see soon. If you get a Roidev issue involved, then we can even override Reish Lakish and it'll work better. We'll see how that works in a minute. Yes?
My problem is, how can you be sure that these people are going to keep their word?
Good.
Except this one, how do you know they're not going to kill you all anyway?
Good. And the other way, how do you know if you call their bluff and say, we're not handing anyone, then they say, okay, we'll go away. They may not kill anybody. That's a very, very good point. Which is, in the case of handing people over, there's always a possibility of it may not happen. And that may be one of the reasons that Rabbi Yochanan and Reish Lakish are arguing. I brought you in the footnotes, there are a number of ways of seeing the difference between Reish Lakish and Rabbi Yochanan. Reish Lakish may be turning around and saying, no, you can't hand anybody over, because you're not sure that it's going to happen. Whereas Rabbi Yochanan may be saying, you know something, in all likelihood, if they say that, they're going to do that, you have to hand the guy over. There are other ways to understand the machlokes between them. Maybe one is more utilitarian, one is less utilitarian. I brought that in this footnote. Yes?
It would be a difference, it seems to me, if the Beit Din had already
passed in on them. Good. So that would answer the point over there, that let's say someone who's already been passed in, but that, in our car case, that's not going to help us much. Yes?
In each case, you said the Israel.
Yes.
Are you allowed to hand over a goy?
Good. That's a good question. What is the difference between Jews and non-Jews? Are these halachas, for example, loy samod al dam re'echa is a halacha between Jews and Jews because it's a family thing. For example, what is the English or American law if you see somebody drowning in a river? Are you obligated by American law to jump in and save them? Can they sue you if you choose not to jump in? And the answer is they can't sue you. You do not have, as far as I'm aware, please don't take my American legal advice conclusive, but they cannot sue you if you choose not to jump in. Obviously, if you're a lifeguard, they can sue you, okay? Because that's your job. You have a duty of care. If you do choose to jump in, and then you end up killing them in the process of trying to save them, then the family may be able to sue you for having hurt them, maybe. Then that's where the Good Samaritan laws come in, that if you want to help, then we're not going to sue you. You had a question?
Yeah. What about someone who's having a heart attack and everyone's standing around? Whoever knows how to
take care of it? That's an interesting question. I don't know. If you're a paramedic, yes. If you're just a member of the public, do you have an American law obligation to intervene? Maybe. I'm not sure. But in Loi Samod Adam Riecha, it's basically saying, what the lady said, that even though in a regular case, you do not have an obligation to intervene, like I think is the case in most situations in secular law. If it's a Jewish person, because it's family, You have an extra obligation. You have an obligation to jump in there and try and save the person. So it's you have to treat all people in a fair way, but family you have to do more, which is understandable. It's an interesting case in the car case. If it was a choice between driving into a random person and driving into your cousin or uncle or aunt, would you be justified in making a different judgment there? Let me just move on for a little bit, because we've got a lot to get through. Let's talk about why you can't kill people in order to save other people. It said, my chazis, how do you know that your blood is redder than their blood? Well, I brought you an issue here. Maybe, what if you do know that their blood is less red than your blood? How would you know that? What if the person was a traitor? What's a traitor? A traitor is someone that you know full well is not going to survive. They have a terminal illness. Or a fetus, like we said before. Leave aside the issue of killing the fetus to save the mother. Are you allowed to kill the fetus to save another person? This was a case at the end of World War I, when a German officer raped a Jewish girl, World War I, not World War II, and got her pregnant, and then told a Jewish doctor to kill the fetus, and stuck a gun to his head, and said, if you don't kill the baby, perform an abortion, I'm going to kill you. So again, do we turn around and say, well, who knows whose blood is redder, or do we say, no, this is a fetus, definitely a lower, if you like, level of life than a fully blown human being. Maybe the doctor can perform the abortion rather than being killed because he's being threatened to do the abortion. Or do we not say that? Do we say life is life is life? Even someone who's going to live for half an hour, 2 hours, they have the same value of life as everybody else. And I brought you in the footnotes that itself is an interesting machlokas in the Achronim. Let's go over the page, because I think there are other things we need to do. So far, where are we holding? Rabbi Yochanan is going to turn around and say, if the people are going to die anyway, you can hand them over. So maybe he's going to say you can shoot down the plane. Reish Lakish is going to say, no, they have to be guilty. If they're not guilty, you can't shoot down the plane. Or maybe shooting down a plane is quite different in itself to handing over other people and is more serious intrinsically so. How do we pass him? Do we pass him Rabbi Yochanan or do we pass him Reish Lakish? Because that's going to make a difference. As we said before, Reish Lakish is going to make it much harder for you to hand anybody over. So, to cut a long story short, I'm sorry to tell you this, it's a machlokas Rishonim, and it's a machlokas in the Shulchan Aruch, and it's a machlokas Achronim. It's very unsatisfactory to leave you like that, but that's how it is. So the Eri clearly paskens like Rabbi Yochanan, with a lower bar, and says you are allowed to hand somebody over, even if they're not guilty, as long as you know that they've been specified, and as long as you know they will die anyway. The Rambam clearly rules like Reish Lakish, look in number 14. We'll kill this person. You'll all get killed. They all have to be killed. If they specify, says the Rambam, and they said, as long as you know that this person is liable for the death penalty like Sheva bin Bichri, then you can give him to them. We shouldn't really tell people this. If the guy is not chayiv misa like Shevin Bichri, yargu kulam va'al yimsur lehem nefesh achat misra. You can't hand anybody over. And tragically, if you read the responsa from the Holocaust, Rav Oshri's safer responsa from the Holocaust, this was something that came up time and time and time again. Where the Nazis, Yimach Shram, said, hand this one over, hand that one over, choose this person, choose that person, we choose you. These were cases that were happening on a regular basis, and working out how this halacha is actually finally decided became life and death issues. The Ramban Shulchan Aruch brings both opinions. Look in number 15. The Ramban Shulchan Aruch, Tnu lana echad mechem v'dargeu. If they say, give us over a person and we'll kill them, lo yitnu lahem echad mechem, you can't give one over, ele'im ken yachdu v'amru, only if they specify them. Okay? They don't have to be guilty, they just have to be specified. And some people say, no, you can't. What are you going to do? Two opinions in the Shulchan Aruch. And different achronims, the Bach says he thinks that the Ramah is leaning towards the Rambam, and others disagree. And I brought you some notes here in the bottom as to how that might work. And as I said to you before, all of this analysis, I'm afraid to say, may be entirely irrelevant. Because we're not handing anybody over. We're actually veering a car or a plane right into them. And therefore the Meiri says clearly, number 17, Mikol Markim Yire, it seems to me, Shaloi Huta Ela Lamasroloi. All that we're ever talking about here is to hand someone over. Shema Yikach Mimenu Kaifer, or Yitcharit Alav, because like the lady said over there, maybe you could bribe them, maybe they'll change their mind, maybe they'll not kill them. Aval Lahargu V'yadayim. But to actually say, I'm going to kill this person, no one ever suggested you could do that. The most that we're ever talking about is handing somebody over. So at the moment, it's not looking like we can program a car to actively kill people in order to save other people, even more people at the moment. Yes?
In all the cases, no one looks at the situation of Yonah.
What's with Yonah? Meaning that they draw lots and they... Okay, good, we'll get to Yonah. Yonah agreed to be thrown in. We'll get to someone who agrees to be thrown off to save other people. We're going to get to that. One thing which may help us is the Roides factor. What is the Roides factor? So the Rambam clearly said that if somebody is a Roides, clearly you have an obligation to kill the Roides because of Lo Samad Adam Re'echa. What is a Roides? A Roides is someone who is actually chasing after a specified individual to try and kill them. And the Chazon Ish understands that ultimately this halacha is based in the din of Roides. Now with a roidef, the situation changes a little bit. A classic roidef is a murderer who is chasing somebody to kill them. Fine, you are obligated to kill the murderer before they kill the person. But a roidef could be innocent. Take the following case. What about the case of a game hunter who is in the forest trying to hunt a deer? And you see this guy training his sights on this deer in the forest, and you're watching this from afar, and you notice to your horror that the deer is not actually a deer. It's a person wearing a deer hat, stagging around the forest. Maybe he's on a stag night. I don't know. Or something like that. And you notice to your horror that he's about to shoot a person, thinking mistakenly it's a deer. That person is still a roides. That's a roides. He's not guilty. He's not predatory. But he's about to kill someone, and you may have an obligation to kill, let's say you have a gun, to kill the shooter to save the person. Maybe that's a roides case. Or the case of a fetus, which the Rambam says, one of the reasons you can kill a fetus to save the mother is because the fetus is a type of roides who is actually taking the life or threatening the life of the mother. Now, when we looked at abortion there, we said it's not so straightforward because the Gemara there says, well, not really. The fetus is just doing what a fetus normally does. It's not making any choices. It's just being pushed down to be born. But in the end, we do bring in the halacha of roides a little bit there, and the fetus is clearly innocent. Look at the shear on abortion as to how Rodef fits in there, etc. But the Chazon Ish wants to say that maybe these people on the plane, maybe they're a Rodef, effectively, innocently so, but they are threatening the lives of these people, and they have to be shot down and taken out in order to protect the lives of these people. Yes?
The Rambam isn't just talking about threatening their lives.
He's talking about a rape situation as well, correct?
So it doesn't apply only in situations where it's a person...
Good, and that may actually help us and hinder us. I'll tell you why. Good, okay. Definitely there's an issue of sexual assault there as well. If you know you need to save somebody from that, you're allowed to kill. In pedophile cases, etc., this is a relevant scenario as well. But it may actually not help us, because there are those that want to say as follows. Maybe this has got nothing to do with whose blood is redder. Because as we see in the case of the rape scenario, it's nothing to do with blood. You're still not allowed to hand somebody over. So why there are you not allowed to hand somebody over? So it may be that this is a halacha that you're not allowed to hand someone over to help the enemy. That's the problem. You're helping the enemy, and just like you're not allowed to pay large ransoms to people who may, God forbid, kidnap people and want to ransom them away. So even though that person's innocent and you want to get them back, you can't pay large ransoms. Why? Because you're just encouraging people to do this. And therefore, maybe this whole issue is that you can't hand people over to the enemy. It's nothing to do with blood. And therefore, if it's not a case of handing to the enemy, shooting down a plane, maybe that makes it easier. Because I'm not handing anyone over to the enemy in that way. I'm doing something a little bit different. It's not an analogous case. All of this is discussed. The Chazon Ish. Look over to page number 7. And this is where I think it gets very relevant to our case. The Chazon Ish has an analysis in Hilchos Sanhedrin about the following. Look at what he says, and then I'll tell you what the original Shiloh was. Look at number 18. V'yesh la'ayin. You see a missile heading to kill a large number of people. And you can hack into the missile and you can divert it somewhere else. To the side. And it'll only kill one person. And you can make that choice. And the other people, the multitude on that side, well, they will be saved. Okay? The imloyatiklum, if you do nothing, yargu arabim, the many people will be killed, the ha'echad yishar b'chaim, but this one person innocently minding his own business over the other side of the valley, he will be fine. The esha the loy damil amoysim echad la'arika. Maybe this case is not the same as handing someone over to be killed. Meaning, if we apply what we said before, are you allowed to kill one person to save many?
No.
No. If they're going to die anyway? Maybe. If they're guilty like Sheva ben Bichri, even more so. But this one person who's sitting there minding his own business at the other side of the valley, and you're thinking of diverting the missile to kill him, is he going to die anyway if you do nothing? No. Is he guilty of anything? No. This is a very similar case to the car, where you're thinking, shall I divert the car and kill this person to save these people? He says, maybe it's not the same. Dahasam hamatsirahu pu'ulaha zariya. This is a very important point. There, handing someone over is a cruel act. Shel harigat nefesh. That's an act of murder. Over pu'ulah zeh, and this kind of act, leka hatzalat acherim b'teva shel hapu'ulah. There's nothing actually saving anybody directly by the act that you're doing. I'm handing over someone to the enemy. That's not a maisa hatzala. It's a maisa acharut. Okay? It's causing a hatsala l'acherim. Gam hatsala t'acherim kashub b'mashem moisim la'ariga nefesh miyisrael. Even though handing over the person may cause people to be saved, that act is not an act of hatsala. Aval hatayat achet. But if you're able to take the missile and to divert the missile mitzad zeh letzad acher, so from one side to the other, he the ikara pu'ulat hatsala. He wants to make this distinction. That is an act of hatsala. That is not cruel. That is kind. That is an act of saving somebody. And you are not in any way connected with the fact that that person who got killed by the missile would never otherwise have been killed. He just unfortunately is in the wrong place at the wrong time. And since that side there are many people, on the other side there's only one person, you end up back with a utilitarian argument. Here are 100 people. Here's one person. I'm not handing anybody over and doing anything cruel. I'm just saving people. If it's an act of saving people, that I can do. And then I have to start working out how many people am I saving, to how many people are being killed, etc. Very interesting. The Hine, he brings in here, Lulinus Upapus. We'll see who they are in a minute. Okay, Nergu Bishvila Hatzil Et Yisrael. They died, and this brings in your Yona example, or the example of taking lots. They died to save a large number of Jewish people. Kamar Shikot of Rashi, and he brings Rashi, etc. They will see that Rashi in a minute. We see they are the highest of the high. And then at the end he says, Mihu. But maybe he pulls back, he says, maybe actually, you know, it's worse, the missile case. Because I'm actually directly putting the missile towards them to kill them. All I found so far, like we saw in the Meiri, is you're allowed to hand people over. But to kill them directly, maybe we can't do that. So at the beginning he wants to say, I think maybe you can do a ma'aseh hatzala, a pu'ulah shel hatzala, an act of saving, and that's better than handing someone over. And at the end he says, no, maybe it's worse. And he's not sure. Why is the Chazanish talking about this? There's actually a sefer written called I put it here in the notes, what's it called? The Zachor LeDavid. I heard this on a shir and I brought your reference to the shir. The Zachor LeDavid was written by a Talmud of the Chazanish, who writes in that sefer that he was there when this issue came up. What happened? A taxi driver from Haifa was coming down a hill and his brakes failed. And he was heading towards a group of people, mamash exactly our case. Okay? Headed towards a group of people, and he didn't know what to do. He swerved the car into an individual and killed that individual, but saved the group of people. And afterwards, he felt just, he couldn't sleep at night, obviously, about it. And he went to the Chazon Ish and asked him, did I do the right thing or did I do the wrong thing? And the Chazon Ish wanted to say at the beginning, at least before he retracted slightly, I think you did the right thing. It's a Maaseh Hatzalah. You weren't trying to kill one person, you were trying to save many people, and the act that you did was an act of Hatzalah. And then he says, but I'm not sure. The Tzitz Eliezer picks this up, and he is sure. And he disagrees completely with the Chazon Ish. And he says, absolutely not. And I brought you a couple of lines here from the Tshuva of the Tzitz Eliezer, looking at number 19. ולכן נראה לפי אני הזדהיתי בכל כגוין דה של חכיר את החזן איש. In this case of the חזן איש, כדי יוצא השב ואל תעשה עדף. The best answer is שב ואל תעשה. You cannot do anything. He says you just have to let things take their course. Just one second. כי הרי יש נתנה של מי חז יש דמה של זה, סומק מדמה של חברי, because you don't know whose blood is redder. One person is 100 people, 1,000 people. So let me just read a bit more of this. Ubahariga vadayis, if you're definitely going to kill somebody, ein chiluk ben yachid l'rabim. It doesn't matter if there's one or if there's hundreds. The lo yamrin in the rabim adifa. We never say that many people take precedence or priority over one person. Umasatirai, he brings a proof from the Rabbeinu Yonah. And if you read the rest of that paragraph, he clearly analyzes that the only correct halakhic action to do, according to him, is if the brakes fail, you just have to let the car go where it goes. If you can swerve the car into a ditch and kill nobody, then of course try and do that. But you cannot kill one person to save many. He disagrees clearly with the Chazon Ish. Yes, sir?
The assumption is you're weighing certainties against certainties. In the case of the taxi driver, almost certainly there was a certainty versus probability.
Which was the probability, that he doesn't know he's going to kill somebody.
No, he just happens to kill
somebody. Good, so you're going to say that if you're not sure you're going to kill someone, you should certainly swerve.
Yes.
Okay, good. But you've changed the case, which is fine. In that case, you could argue more that you should definitely swerve. But what if you know? What if it's Vadai versus Vadai? Oh, so you want to say that the Tzitz Eliezer is dealing with a different case to the Chazon Ish. So because the Chazon Ish is the case of the missile, it's too definite. That's his case. You're definitely going to kill these, or you're definitely going to kill those. That's the case. Yes. Sorry, I'll come to both of you. Sorry. Good. So we talked about good. So we that's a whole different shear. We talked a little bit about that when we talked about the terrorism situation. We had a shear on: are you allowed to kill civilians in order to kill terrorists? If some terrorists hold up in a building firing missiles off the top of a hospital or an ambulance, how does that work?
That, your own
good. Once I get into that, we'll never get finished by 11 o'clock. So or 12 o'clock. Yes.
The plane in 9/11 did the right thing.
Which one? The one where the passengers downed it.
Oh,
so that gets into exactly this next case. They managed to down the plane in an area where there was nobody killed on the ground, but the people on the plane, of course, were killed. So when the Chazon Ish referred to this case of Lulinus and Paphos, what was the case of Lulinus and Paphos? Anyone know this? This is a Gemara in Tanis, in number 20, and this brings in some of the points that people raised earlier. The Gemara in Tanis says the following. Let's look at a couple of lines. Kishebikish Turianus. Turianus is Trajan, who was the emperor in the beginning of the 2nd century CE, when he wished to kill Arug et Lulinus the Papus. He wanted to kill these two people, Echav Belutia, these were two brothers-in-law. Amalahim, he said to them, if you're from the Jewish people, Yavai Lokeichem, V'yatzilitchem, God will save you, and therefore if God doesn't save you, then you're obviously wrong. And the Gemara goes on and explains that they said, we're not as worthy as them to be saved, and you're not as worthy as Nebuchadnezzar to have a miracle done, and in the end they died. Rashi gives us an interesting side understanding of this in number 21. This is what the Chazon Ish was saying. Belutkia he Lod, that is Lod. The Hanuda Amrin Bachol Duktin, these are the people we're talking about, Haruge Lod, these are the people that died in that massacre, these two brothers. Ein Kol Briye Chol Elamod Bachmachitaton began Eden, they are the highest of the high, meaning they're of the highest level, they gave their lives. The Yesh Amrin, Shenergo Al Bito Shel Melech. They died because of the daughter of the king, Shenimse Haruga, she was found having been murdered. The Amru, Hayuhudim, the Amru, and people said, Hayuhudim Harguha. The Jews killed her with a blood libel. The Gazru Gezera al Soinehem Shav Yisrael, and they made a Gezera on all the Jews that they would be killed. The Amdu Elu, and these two got up voluntarily, Upada is Yisrael, they redeemed Yisrael, the Jewish people, the Amru, and they said, Anu Hargua, we killed her, Saragamelech, Leilu Bilzad, and they just sacrificed their own lives to kill, to save the Jewish people. Now that is like the case of the Lot, that is like the case maybe of Yonah, etc., when he says, they agreed to be killed to save other people. It sounds like that is allowed, which is very interesting. Because again, if you're going to buy your car, let's say they give you an option. This could be in 30 years. You're going to take your driverless car and they give you options. And they say, sir, we can either program it that you will die rather than other people, or that 10 will die rather than 20. So you tell us, what would you prefer? So is this going to be like the Mahadran option? Where you'll say that I wish to be martyred rather than kill other people, and maybe you don't have to. I mean, it seems funny, but it's like, exactly, how is that going to work? Do Lulinus and Papos give us any guidance on that? And the last matter, just before we finish with the final situation, is what do we do about Chaye Shah? How do we view life which is coming soon to an end? Meaning, these people in the plane, what's their story? They're not going to live very long anyway. Do we turn around and say that those lives definitely are less than people who have a full lifespan who are going to live a normal life or not? And the Shulchan Aruch seems to say that in certain circumstances there is a difference. For example, it says here in number 22, you're not allowed to go to a doctor that you suspect of being a murderer. Okay, maybe you didn't have many options back in the day, but you're not allowed to go to a doctor who you suspect of maybe they'll kill you. Because, of course, you're liable for your own life, and you can't put your life in danger. But, says the Shulchan Aruch, if they told you that you're, God forbid, terminally ill, and you only have a day or two to live anyway, so then you are allowed to risk it. Why? Because he says at the end, the l'chai shah lo yichashin of it. Because that kind of very temporary life is not something that we're as worried as you risking than a life which is a proper lifespan. And that the Shlutz Yaakov actually gave a tshuva based on this and said, what if a person has been told that they only have a few days to live, but they could have an operation which will probably kill them, but may save them? Okay? Should they have an operation that may well kill them, but could save them, given that they only have 2 or 3 days to live? And again, there he says, because the Chaye Shah, the temporary life expectation, does make a difference here. But again, in our case of the cars, the people you're swerving into are not terminally ill. Okay? That's not the case. It may have an impact on organ donation. And that whole discussion as to whether you take the organs from this one to save that one. But again, what is Chaye Shah? We're not going to turn around and say, well, old healthy people have got less years to live than young healthy people, therefore that's called Chaye Shah, and that's called... No, we're not going to say that. There are limits to how far that goes, and I brought you other examples. The case of Dudley and Stephen is a case that they taught us at law school. And it's quite a famous case of what they call lifeboat ethics. Okay? Where it was a case in the late 1800s where 4 men were shipwrecked. 3 of them were, one of them was an officer and a senior officer and the captain, etc. And one of them was the cabin boy. And they basically had nothing to eat and drink for days. They found a turtle, they ate that. They had a couple of cans of pumpkins or something, they ate those. But eventually they had nothing to eat and nothing to drink. The cabin boy decided to drink seawater against everybody's advice. And he then went into a coma, was deathly ill. The other 3 didn't drink the seawater, but were clearly dying. And they had to make a decision, are they going to kill the cabin boy and eat him in order to survive? First of all, they said, let's draw lots. And they didn't agree on drawing lots. And in the end, the captain says, I'm going to kill the cabin boy. And they killed him and ate him.
Rabbi Manning, when I saw the title to this year, I thought we were going to decide whether we can get into an autonomous car and stop and go to school. You know, we're going to get involved in cannibalism and murder and rape.
Well, you know something? Die. Always expect the unexpected. I was thinking about giving a share on whether you can get into a car and go to Shabbos, but I think the answer to that is no. And I'm not sure I could give a whole share about why you would be able to get into an autonomous car drive on Shabbos. If you can't carry an umbrella on Shabbos, I didn't think anyone was going to let you get into an autonomous car. It's going to be different for people who are sick or people who are, you know, maybe hospital cases or army cases, etc. I do want to leave you, and I promise I won't speak about this next week because clearly not everybody wants me to, but I wanted to leave you. This is a whole thought experiment that they call trolleyology. And I just want to leave you on number 9, page 9 and 10. You can look at this in your own time. But there is this famous trolley problem that Philippa Foot, a British philosopher, came up with about 40, 50 years ago, where there's a trolley car going towards 5 people tied to a track, and you're able to actually pull a lever and divert it onto a track and kill 1 person rather than kill 5, and all of the different variations, which are really very fascinating. Most people say that they would pull the lever and allow the one person on the track to be killed rather than the 5, okay? But when you get into the what they call, rather politically incorrectly, the fat man variation, which is where there's a very large person on a bridge, and you can just push them over the bridge to stop the train and avoid the 5 people being killed. Needless to say, a lot less people are happy to do that, and you can read the analysis there. But this may sound like a rather gruesome shear, but at the end of the day, this is a really important halachic moral point. Because soon you won't just be able to go and buy a car. You'll have to choose a car which is programmed in a certain way, and people are going to have to decide what are their priorities. I haven't come to any clear conclusions other than it doesn't seem that we can swerve into people to save other people, but it's not so straightforward. Okay, next week we'll talk about something from the sublime to the equally sublime. We'll talk about something Purim related. It's safe to come back next week. Okay?
So sure the people will die, and I wonder how